U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Joe Biden's presidential transition gets rolling as states like Pennsylvania certify their election results. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jugot. We're joined today by my colleagues, Kim Strassel. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kyle.
And Bill McGurn. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
On Tuesday, the White House gave its okay for Joe Biden to be given access to national security intelligence, specifically the president's daily brief. That followed a letter on Monday from the head of the General Services Administration, Emily Murphy, who essentially designated Biden the official president-elect, making millions of dollars of funding available to the transition, letting it into office space in federal buildings, allowing background checks to get started and so forth. There'd been a lot of chatter about a holdup, but 3 weeks after the election, it seems like the transition is on track. And Kim, here is what Joe Biden told NBC. He said that he's gotten good outreach, sincere outreach from Trump administration officials across the board. And he said, quote, "I think we're going to be not so far behind the curve as we thought we might be in the past."
Yeah, so much for all the hyperventilating and all the stories suggesting that Joe Biden would be forever denied the ability to get resources. You know, I thought that Emily Murphy's statement was pretty straightforward, noting that, you know, the GSA administrator does not pick or certify the winner of an election. It rather needs to wait until the states do some of that. And this, of course, accompanies the news that several states have, in fact, now certified Joe Biden as a winner, allowing GSA to make the determination or ascertainment, as it were, that Joe Biden has the 270 electoral votes that he will need to become president. So they have started the process, and it means gaining access to officials and more than 60 agencies, classified briefings, some money, a lot of money or millions of dollars for office space, and also money to provide orientation sessions and a transition directory to the Biden administration, incoming Biden administration. So, you know, there was a lot of angst over this, but in the end, it kind of worked in my mind exactly the way it was supposed to, a little bit more delayed, but not surprising given that we have had all these challenges.
And Murphy's letter, I think, is worth reading. It's only a couple pages, and she's been criticized for the delay here and defends herself, essentially, saying that nobody in the White House or in the executive branch had pressured her to not determine that Biden was the president-elect. And she also points out, I thought this was an interesting point, that the law gives the GSA no specific procedures or standards for this process. She says the GSA does not dictate the outcome of legal disputes and recounts. It does not determine whether such proceedings are reasonable or justified. And then she called on Congress to fix the law and give the GSA, you know, either take this choice away from the GSA or give it some objective standards. And it seems to me that even if you don't think this particular call was a hard one, that it's not unreasonable. You can have some sympathy with the idea that maybe this isn't the right goal for a what's essentially sort of a procurement agency.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things, you know, where governments recognize other governments not by a formal recognition, but by allowing someone into their waters or letting their flagships go by. I agree. I think the post-election would be nice if we could clean up a lot of this and clarify. I would like to see state legislatures forced to obey the Constitution and so forth. I think there's a lot of cleanup we can do to take those decisions, you know, out of the hands of basically a bureaucrat and put them where they should be. I do think that so much of this, you know, there was so much angst. It seems like just a classic Beltway story. Again, in 2000, George W. Bush didn't get his transition office and his money until December 13th. You know, that's almost 3 weeks from now. So, you know, these things are forgotten pretty quickly. I do think it's a de facto recognition by Donald Trump about where this is heading.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask about next, because in a tweet on Monday, President Trump thanked Emily Murphy. And here's what he said. He said, "Our case strongly continues. We will keep up the good fight, and I believe we will prevail. Nevertheless, in the best interest of our country, I'm recommending that Emily and her team do what needs to be done with regard to initial protocols," unquote. And so on one hand, Kim, clearly that's not a concession by the president, but it does read to me at least like a sort of de facto admission that the Biden transition needs to move forward, and that by extension, that there's probably going to be a new president on January 20th.
Well, I mean, let's point out that in the aftermath of those tweets about Emily Murphy, the president has also said, "I concede nothing," and pointed out again that the GSA does not determine who the next president of the United States will be. And, you know, he's had various other tweets sort of saying, look, allowing this to proceed in no way gets in the way of our legal challenges, et cetera. So, I mean, I don't in any way view it as a concession. I think you'd probably look at it more if you were a Trump voter of the president saying, hey, yeah, we're going to roll with this because of the certifications. Now, I mean, yes, in a certain way, it would certainly seem as though there's a conclusion there that this may be headed in a certain direction, and that, you know, that there's probably a benefit for the Biden team and the country to work together. I think that that's notable, by the way, too, considering all of the press reports suggesting that the president would never allow such a thing. Part of that tweet that you quoted actually had him saying that not only, you know, had he given his blessing to the GSA, but also to his team to reach out and work with Mr. Biden. And as that Biden statement made clear, they have had that outreach. So, I mean, I still think of this in two ways, that the president is still pursuing his legal strategy. It still doesn't look good, but, you know, they're going to fight that still to the bitter end, although that end may be coming soon.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to me at least that the president's legal team and his campaign is really running out of road here. Over the weekend, a conservative federal judge in Pennsylvania ruled against the Trump legal team's claims. And then we've had all these states certified. Michigan certified on Monday, Pennsylvania and Nevada certified on Tuesday. There's a couple of recounts going on, but it's hard to see that changing. I mean, in Georgia, Tuesday, there was an official recount begun there, and the ballots there, remember, have already been recounted by hand once. They're now being run through the scanners again, and the deadline to finish there is December 2, I believe. But it's hard to see that changing the 12,000 vote deficit. And two counties in Wisconsin, Bill, are also doing recounts, but the deficit there is even bigger. It's about 21,000 votes.
Yeah, I don't have any disagreement. Look, facts on the ground are being established. It was always a long shot to find not only fraud or miscounting, but on a sufficient scale that would overturn the election. Again, I go back, it seems to me it's the same rules in college football. When they relook at a play, even if it's a bad play and maybe you think the call went the wrong way, unless there is overwhelming evidence that it was wrong, they leave the ruling on the field. And we're getting a lot of rulings on the field from these courts. So is it still possible something pans out? Yes, but no one seems to see it. And I mean, to the degree that I've looked at some of the claims, you know, they haven't held up well when judges have actually examined them. Now, there may be other claims they have that they have not yet made public, but from what I've seen, they just haven't held up. So I think people in the Trump administration have to brace for the inevitable. I do think it's a good, I was glad to see Trump's tweet on the GAO for something that Kim mentioned. You know, it puts a lot of people in the administration in a tough position. You know, if Joe Biden is going to be the president, they have some responsibilities to prepare him. And it's unfair to, you know, to hold them up for contempt as undermining the president when they're just doing their job. So I was glad to see at least that the president acknowledged, so some of these people can go about doing their jobs without fears that they're going to be, you know, touted as a Benedict Arnolds and so forth for not, you know, sticking with Trump's claims to the bitter end.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Speaking of the bitter end, it does seem to me also that there's a sort of a growing push among elements of the Republican Party, some of the leadership, former leadership, to accept what appears to be inevitable here. And I'll cite a few examples. So after the Saturday court ruling by that federal judge, Senator Pat Toomey, Pennsylvania Republican, congratulated President-elect Biden and said that President Trump has, quote, exhausted all plausible legal options. After Michigan certified, Senator Bill Cassidy said this. He said, President Trump's legal team has not presented evidence of the massive fraud which would have had to be present to overturn the election. I voted for President Trump, but Joe Biden won. Unquote. There's similar statements being made by Chris Christie, Liz Cheney. And then interestingly, here's Paul Ryan on Tuesday. He says, these legal challenges to the outcome and the attacks on our voting system really need to stop, in my opinion. The outcome will not be changed, and it will only serve to undermine our faith in our system of government, our faith in our democracy, unquote. So, Kim, I mean, do you think I'm right that there's a growing movement here in the GOP?
Sure. And I think it's safe to say that you are going to see more officials, more public figures, whether in government at the moment or in politics at the moment or whether retired, come out and make those statements. I think it's also pretty accurate to predict that none of that will necessarily matter to the Trump team. And that this will nonetheless continue to go on until the court circuit is done. And, you know, the window for that, again, is it's growing smaller because at a certain point you are going to have electors meet and cast their votes, at which point those court challenges won't really matter. And that's why you've seen the Trump team talking vaguely so far, but about trying to go to some of these states and getting electors to vote for a different slate than for a different candidate than that certified by the state. That, in my mind, is even a bigger long shot than some of these court challenges. But my point is, this is just going to continue. We're going to have a couple more weeks of this, probably about 2.5 before 2 weeks before you have that electoral college vote. And we're going to continue to see the court cases. I find it very hard to believe that even with all of these officials coming out and making their statements, that that will influence what the Trump team continues to do in court.
But it is interesting now that we're running sort of on parallel tracks because the Biden transition is moving forward. The states are certifying and the electors are being chosen. And at some point they're going to vote. But we still have the president saying he's going to keep up the fight and he's going to prevail. And now these things are sort of running alongside each other. And so, Bill, I mean, do you think that there's no presidential concession that's required by law? Nothing hinges on a concession here. But do you think that it's important for the country or for the Republican Party for the president at some point, if his legal challenges fall flat and the electors vote, to concede officially?
I do. But I also think that it's unlikely to succeed if people are trying to lecture him into doing it, and especially lecture his voters. You know, whatever Donald Trump does, he's not going to be in Washington after the inauguration, right? He may be bitter, he may be yelling, but he's not going to be there. I'm more concerned to who's going to be in the Senate. And I think we need those Republican voters, the Trump supporters, to come out and save the Republican Senate. I mean, my argument to President Trump would be less about 2024 than right now. He's had significant achievements, you know, in judges and getting the economy revived with tax cuts and deregulation, a lot of changes. And he needs a Republican Senate to stop Joe Biden from undoing them all. You know, for example, from swamping his three Supreme Court picks by packing the Supreme Court, adding new seats or adding new senators from other states. So right now, what I detect is a lot of resentment on both sides. I saw that one of the president's lawyers, Lynn Wood, I think, was talking about showing Republicans a lesson, you know, in Georgia by not supporting them unless they're stronger in their support for President Trump. I would go the other way. I think the real message for the president is, you know, a lot of your legacy, you had a lot of genuine achievements, but it's on the line in Georgia, and you need your supporters to come out to preserve a Republican Senate and preserve your achievements.
I mean, I think that's right. And I guess I would pick something even more mundane, which is the deregulation that the president has done. Right. And if the Democrats take over the Senate, win those one or two of those runoffs in Georgia, they'll be allowed to use the Congressional Review Act, essentially, to legislatively undo a lot of those regulatory changes, Kim, that the president has passed through. So, I mean, it does seem to me, I agree with Bill, that a lot of the president's legacy here hinges on what happens in Georgia in January.
Yeah, and they could do a lot more than just a Congressional Review Act. I mean, remember, we're also talking about 51 votes to pass a budget and potentially reverse all the tax cuts that the president and Republicans put forward a couple of years ago. And that's before you get to some of those really big name threats out there from progressives like packing the courts or, you know, statehood for Puerto Rico or Washington, D.C. So there can be no question that there is a potential real problem of Republicans remaining too focused on these presidential recounts and not pouring their energy and activism into Georgia, which we're definitely seeing Democrats do. I mean, the money is just flowing in. You've got organizations like Act Blue, which was the kind of clearinghouse for financial support for Democratic candidates. They were a big reason why Democrats did so well in fundraising and out-fundraised Republicans in this last presidential. They are on, you know, currently already getting money for the Democrats down there. You've got big names that are doing fundraisers for them. You've got activists and groups setting up for get out the vote efforts. You know, Republicans need to be all hands on board there agree completely that president's legacy right now rests through Georgia.
Meanwhile, Joe Biden on Tuesday formally announced some of his first big cabinet picks at a press event, including his choices for Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. And we talked about this a little bit yesterday, but Bill, here's what Biden said at that event. He said, "It's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it, once again sit at the head of the table," unquote. But then I thought it was a little bit humorous when he was both highlighting these guys' decades of experience and then also trying to convince people that they had fresh thinking and perspectives.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're going to see. Look, Joe Biden, he's, you know, if he's won the election, going to be sworn in. Presidents have a right to their own team. And he's chosen a lot of people that are like him, veterans of the Obama administration, and like him, sort of liberal internationalists. They They don't mind being involved abroad so long as it's sort of done under the auspices of the UN or the or NATO or the WHO or something like that, some other international organization. The real question, I think, will be, as always with any kind of liberal progressive administration, whether they will be able to use force where necessary. I mean, Democrats have a real problem with America's use of force in protect of America's interests. Now, Mr. Blinken, Secretary of State, has, you know, has made some encouraging noises on this about superpowers not bluffing. But I think Joe Biden's going to be very skittish about any use of force. Remember, Donald Trump was an odd kind of foreign policy because it wasn't the traditional Republican foreign policy, which he blasted all the time. He thought we were too involved. You know, his tendencies were against multilateral agreements, against having troops overseas, against a lot of things that Republicans had traditionally stood for. On the other hand, he did bomb Syria twice. He was willing to use force when he thought it's necessary. I'm kind of interested to see whether Joe Biden's administration is going to be just a throwback to leading from behind of Barack Obama, or whether it'll be something different.
And Kim, since we talked about some of these in your absence yesterday, but since you weren't here, I just wanted to get your read on some of these specific choices that Biden is making for these posts.
Well, right. I mean, look, I think the thing that matters here is that a lot of these guys are throwbacks to Obama years. What's concerning about that, and Bill just touched on it, is that, you know, the Obama administration was a mess on foreign policy, which is why it's so amusing these days to talk about Biden talking about how America is back. I mean, the America I remember under Barack Obama was the America that, you know, laid out a red line in Syria and then didn't follow through after its use of chemical weapons. That, by contrast to, as Bill just mentioned, Donald Trump bombing the country. You know, the Obama team I remember was responsible for that horrible Iran nuclear deal, which basically gave that country all the cards and also freed it up to grow even more powerful in the region, did very little to check that growth, and has resulted in a great deal of instability, and is one of the reasons why you now see different countries moving to forge new relationships with Israel, because there's been a pressure to realign and to recognize the growing Iranian threat. And that threat really came to be on Obama's watch. So, you know, we'll see these guys and what their approach is this time around. But listening to Biden sort of tout about America being back, it just is no real reflection on the history of his last period in office.
So, Kim, let me ask you this then. Do you foresee any challenges in confirmation for these guys? I mean, they're pretty establishment figures, but there's been some notable pushback, I think, from the right, from the Senate. I mean, Marco Rubio is calling Biden's cabinet picks polite and orderly caretakers of America's decline. Senator Josh Hawley, even stronger. Here's what he tweeted. What a group of corporatists and war enthusiasts and big tech sellouts.
Yeah, look, we'll see. I mean, you will probably have a contingency of Republicans who vote against many of Biden's cabinet picks. Will it be consequential? Maybe not, because I think you'll have just as many Republicans, or maybe not just as many, but a handful or enough Republicans who operate under a standard that I generally subscribe to as well, which is that, you know, presidents deserve to have generally the people that they pick around them. And when they put their nominees forward, you know, barring some evidence of gross incompetence or some form of corruption or something else that disqualifies them at a level for office, that they deserve to have the people that they choose. And I have always had that view with Republican presidents, with Democratic presidents, with their judicial nominees. Now, will that be the case this time? That probably these fights have become more and more antagonistic. Democrats gave their own grief to Republicans over any number of Donald Trump's picks when he came in. Will there be a, you know, you gave it to us, we're going to give it to you attitude among some Republicans? Yes. But it, given how closely divided the Senate is going to be, I think that you're going to have enough Republicans who have that attitude about a president's prerogatives, a president's team, that they'll vote with Democrats probably to get most of these folks through.
All right, we'll leave it there today. Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.